This tape is a production of All Roads Ministry. Your speaker is Vin Lewis, founder and president of All Road Ministry. This particular tape is entitled Sin. This tape is in what we call our Christian Basics section. In other words, in this tape, we shall attempt to take an impartial, non-denominational approach to basic situations, values, and issues in Christianity. In other words, we shall not start out from a sectarian point of view, but from what we consider basics of Christianity, necessary logic, and right reason, and see if we can come to some basic conclusions and possibly resolve some of the issues which seem to trouble all those who call themselves Christian. In dealing with the concept of sin, I would like to first point out that there seems to be two separate but related senses which correspond to the separate but related classifications of sin. The first is this sense of what is wrong with mankind. In other words, why does mankind never be able to seem to, quote, get it together, unquote? Why is it that the history of the world is filled with good intentions which do not realize themselves in execution? Why do each one of us fail at what we try to do? Why does the guard fall asleep when he is guarding his loved ones? Why does fatigue set in? Why do we grow impatient even with ourselves? Why does the man, even if he were on a desert island, wind up becoming frustrated and annoyed? In other words, what is wrong with mankind so that every human being can see what should be done, but every human being seems incapable of doing it? This collective sense, or universal sense, of that there's something wrong with us is generally considered as, say, an explanation and a result of original sin. By original sin, we mean the fall of man, by quite literally fall from that exalted preternatural state, the state in which Adam and Eve were created by God, to the present state, the fallen nature. But the second concept of sin is what we participate in ourselves whenever we do things that is wrong. That is to say, actual sin, when we do something wrong ourselves. And I think it's important at this point to make two points. Number one, most of this tape, unless I specify otherwise, will be dealing with actual sin. When I say sin, I mean actual sin. And second, I believe I should define the word sin. And again, unless I make a specific exception, I'm dealing with actual sin. Sin is that act of body, mind, soul, or will, which is not in accord with God's will for man. Notice that this definition is negative. This is unavoidable. This definition explains sin as something which is not, rather than something which is. I believe that this is the correct understanding of sin. Some people like to point out that the word sin is an English word translated from a Hebrew word which refers to an archery effort to fall short of the mark. This is only one explanation of sin, because sin may certainly be an act of omission, a failure. Certainly if one fails to pay his proper debt because one forgets and is negligent, that is one thing. However, to consciously cheat a creditor by forging documents or destroying the agreement of a debt is an act of commission. That is to say, commission requires a conscious act by a person to bring about a result, while an act of omission requires the avoidance of what one is supposed to do. Both actions certainly are sin by any reasonable definition of that word. There is another important qualification of sin which I think should be dealt with, another necessary aspect, or at least I believe it is necessary, and allow me to approach it somewhat indirectly. I state that sin is a universal sense. As I said before, when dealing with original sin, there is a universal sense that something is wrong. There are also universal senses which have been reflected throughout the literature, law, and ethics and culture of mankind, that certain things are forbidden, to man in proper behavior, and that certain things are allowed only in certain conditions. In other words, quite simply, a man is allowed to have sexual relations with his wife. He is not allowed to have them with his daughter. He is allowed to punish and raise his children. He is not allowed to punish and raise the children of his neighbor. Now, these are general principles, and sometimes there are exceptions. But the point is, we find these universal senses of what is allowed and what is not allowed reflected throughout all of mankind. I think the way this arises is through a universal sense or acknowledgement of what bothers us as humans. In other words, it is the wisdom of the ages passed down through the experience of the generation before, codified in some type of rule and regulation. It is that instinctual, if we're allowed to use that word, or inherent recognition of wrong when we see it by some inherent value system in us. And I point out that not everything that goes wrong bothers and troubles us. It is only sin, those things which bother and trouble us in a quite different way, which we pass laws against and try to prevent. To bring out this point a little further, I shall talk about the concept of an accident, a pure accident, something which, quote, simply happens. Now, there are psychological theories that hold that there is no such thing as an accident, and all accidents are actually latent thoughts or subconscious desires. I'm not concerned with that. I'm simply pointing out the following to give an example of a pure accident. A person is operating an automobile, driving down the road, has a heart attack, he loses consciousness, and loses controls of the car. The car crosses over a divider and runs over a family member of yours. You are extremely bothered. You are extremely upset. You feel the sense of loss or the sense of injury of your family member, but by no means do you feel guilty. By the same token, if you had an activity planned for a particular day, let's say a picnic, and at the last moment it rains, or you find out for some reason the park is closed because of a plane crash, you are upset. You are troubled, but you do not feel guilty. This concept of guiltiness deals with the concept of responsibility. In both cases, something happened which will induce sorrow, possibly anger, frustration in you, but not guilt. The reason there is no guilt is in neither of these incidences are you responsible. In neither case could you have foreseen the event and prevented it by any way. You did not have the power to foresee it, nor did you have the power to prevent it. The specific aspects here of sin that I'm dealing with is the concept that sin must be avoidable and it must be foreseeable. For it to be avoidable and foreseeable, which means recognizable, there must be a standard by which one can know such things in advance. In other words, you must be aware that having sex with your daughter is wrong, or punishing your neighbor's child is wrong, and you must be aware of this before you do it. There is this universal sense in us, it's generally referred to as natural law. Now, if you could not see this in advance, you should not feel guilty, nor would we punish people for taking these actions, which are universally condemned. As a matter of fact, many universally condemned languages are never codified in law. They are simply understood as evil. Again, without the foreseeable situation, without the responsible situation, there may be pain, but there is not guilt, at least not guilt for this mentally and spiritually healthy person. Now, if we are responsible for sin, and by that I mean we could have recognized it if we had taken the effort to learn, and could have avoided it if we had taken the effort to do, then there must, by definition, because of this guilt that comes as a result of our sinning, there must be some aid, some knowledge, some treatment, some approach by which we can learn sin, and there must be some way that we can deal with the guilt that comes. This follows from the logical argument that if God instilled these inherent values in us as to what is right and wrong, and with the consequences that we feel guilty, if God did this without a remedy, then God is cruel. And certainly, since we're dealing in a Christian concept, God cannot be cruel. Therefore, there must be a remedy to this. There must be some way of getting rid of the guilt. There must be some way of avoiding sin. We do all sin. We do all feel guilty because, again, we could have all avoided the sin. Now, again, the conclusions that follow from this, the positions that I've gotten to at this point is, number one, help is available, both in avoiding sin and recognizing it. Two, we don't always use it. Three, sin must be able to be recognized before it occurs. Let me try again to use an analogy here in a medical situation. We all know that we should take care of our teeth. We may not know the chemical reactions for tooth decay, and we may not know the chemical contents of toothpaste, but we all know that we should take care of our teeth. If we do not, in a natural course of events, we will suffer pain, we will suffer illness, and ultimately toothache and loss of our teeth. But, nonetheless, we don't always seek the dentist. Why? In a certain sense, this is the human dilemma, the human problem. Even though we can see what's coming, we do sin. We do avoid taking the help that is available to us. Let us deal with the results of sin right now, because although we all should avoid sin, I think we all do, as St. Paul says in the book of Romans, the evil I would avoid, I do, while the good I would do, I fail to do. The simple psychological, true psychological insight into human behavior and the simple philosophical concept of human existence having meaning tells us that this sense of guilt, this sense of being bothered, which comes about from sin, is eased by confession and by fulfilling a sense of reparation. In other words, we sense clearly that when we have done something wrong, we should admit it to an authority structure, and number two, do something to make it right. We sense that a debt has been created and should be paid or remitted. By paid, I mean that you pay it back. Remitted means that somehow it is removed. If it is paid, justice is satisfied. If it is remitted, it is eliminated and forgiven, and mercy is exercised. One of the great problems of Christian theology has been this apparent dichotomy between the concept of justice and mercy. If God requires payment for sin, then he does not remit the debt and is not merciful. But if he is merciful, then he does not require a payment, and he is not just. This has been a dichotomy. I will make a rough attempt at reconciling them now. Sin is an offense against God. No payment made by us is sufficient to make things right. Simply because we are human, we are not capable of offering divine reparation, which would be sufficient to satisfy the offense against the divine person, the divine majesty. Now, God could, in theory, simply forgive everything we do all the time at once. But this would conflict with the inherent value system of us, which says that we, our own sense of justice is violated, that we see sin as an injustice, and that we feel some obligation to make reparation. Again, if God created us in this way, then the reason he created us this way was to bring us closer through right reason and natural behavior to his truth. In other words, he wouldn't have put these feelings in us unless he meant them to be in accord with his will. Again, they're universal, they're throughout mankind, they're in the highest cultures and in the best aspects of law. We must do something ourselves to make up for what we have done. Now, again, God could forgive everything, but it would violate that basic principle. We humans want to pay back, we want to confess, we want to set things back to normal, we want to clear the slate so ahead, and then we want it forgotten. Forgive and forget. That's what we want. We want God to forgive and forget. We want forgiveness based on something we do, and then we want the forgetting as a gift. So in other words, we want a part that is our justice and a part that is God's mercy. I hope that at this point you've seen the incarnational nature of this seeping into this talk. It was the God-man Jesus who paid the human debt, which only the God-man could pay. The infinite price paid because of the infinite suffering of the perfect God-man on the cross. But let me get back to our basic situations. Sin creates in us an imbalance. We want to set that right. It is, in the true sense of the word, a dis-ease. But, like any dis-ease, the only way we can treat it with our own will is to first admit it and then seek help from an authority. This admission, quite literally, is confession. The second thing is following the therapy of the doctor. Again, I'm dealing with the medical analogy. The therapy, the procedure, the treatment. We take our medicine, so to speak. Now, this basic type of compensation, this basic type of doing something, means confession, acknowledgement by an authority, reparation, therapy, restitution. All of these things follow from the sense of sin. We want to be forgiven. We want our debt forgiven. We want it paid in full. This help, if it is to be available, this procedure, which is so clearly symbolized in the analogy in the medical procedure, must be available in Christianity. And again, Scripture makes it clear that confession has something to do with sin. Most of the major failings in most Christian denominations, so to speak, in Christian churches, is that they don't make the confession ritualistic, they don't make it specific, they don't make it authoritative. The major failing of most churches in this area is that there is no penalty, no penance. And without that, the confession becomes meaningless. The confessions which take place, the mass type of vague, amorphous confessions that somehow the congregation has failed, usually means the following. Something like this: we sinners approach you, God. This means, number one, no one is really listening to what we say. No one really specifically admits a wrong. No one really judges what the nature of our wrong is, how significant it is, how significant it isn't, and no one really replies. What we are in a case like this is we are self-accusers. We are accusing ourselves of something wrong. But as every human being knows, in a time of emotional stress and in a time of guilt, it's not the proper time to consider your judgment absolutely impartial. It's best to take it to an impartial judge. But there is no impartial judges in the vast majority of Christian churches. Of course, the Orthodox Communion and the Catholic Communion have the confessional box, the confessional nature, the sacrament of confession. Then, and only then, do we sense that remission can take place. If there is no effort, no price, no activity on man's part to make reparation, then we can be certain of one thing: that no matter how inadequate our attempt may be, no reparation, no effort whatsoever means no satisfaction whatsoever. In other words, you may claim that my penance that I am given when I go through the sacrament of confession is not enough. But the key point is, whether that is enough or not, if I do nothing at all, we guarantee it is not enough. There is a psychological, a spiritual, a almost physical need which has man cry out to do something to make up for the offense of his sin. Even again, if the person is forgiven by the authority after confession, even if the authority who listens to the sin imposes no penance, then we have a situation in which this freedom, this reparation, or determination that there is no reparation necessary, has been determined by an outside party. This is the inherent difference between the criminal who goes to trial, purges himself, and walks out a free man because he beat the rap, he beat the system, he perverted the system, or the criminal who, after being found guilty, is given a suspended sentence by an impartial judge who says, although you are guilty of this crime, you did not deserve punishment. In that case, is an impartial authority saying, as Jesus said to the woman caught in adultery, go and sin no more. It is not a woman caught in adultery saying, thank you very much, I forgive myself. No. Without sin, without the physical expression of acknowledgement of sin, of confession of sin, of reparation of sin, of an impartial judge, of a ritualistic behavior, the satisfaction which is necessary in all of us will not be taken place. In other words, just as we have the rituals in court, we need the rituals in religion to satisfy us in this way. when there is still a doubt as whether the full penalty has been paid or not, then what we have is, again, another sense of disease. Instead of reparation, instead of remission, we now have a doubt in whether enough was done. And what is set up, it is an imbalance, an inherent imbalance in the sinner, who either thinks that all sin is immediately forgiven, the all-merciful God who ignores all things, I'll get to that in a moment about how this can't possibly be in the Christian situation, or you get to the situation that nothing you do is enough, which leads ultimately to the pessimism and predestinationism and the pure craziness, scrupulousness of Calvin and Luther. Because in that case, what we come up with is the concept of nothing I do is enough, therefore, why bother to try? We're all doomed anyway, or we're all not doomed anyway, no matter what we do. But this destroys the whole sense of good works, the whole sense of living for God, the whole sense of serving one's neighbor, the whole sense of accepting truth, the whole sense of bearing witness to the truth, the whole sense of living a life that is worth giving up for a value beyond it. Because if these things aren't good, if they don't make, in a certain sense, reparation for the evil we've done, then what we have is a situation where no good can be advocated. Again, totally inconsistent with the Christian behavior. Now, let me approach for a moment on the concept that Jesus automatically paid for the sins of every human being who ever lived on the face of the earth on the cross. This is a position that many fundamentalists take, and it is inherently flawed. I will explain why now. If Jesus paid for every sin that any man ever did, then there's no way to get to hell. And Jesus talks about people going to hell. Generally, the fundamentalist will argue that the proper way to get to hell, so to speak, is to reject Jesus' gift of the payment on the cross, or to reject his words, or to reject Jesus. Now, clearly, to reject Jesus, to denounce Jesus, to blaspheme against Jesus, to refuse to accept his gift, to refuse to accept his love, to hate Jesus, any of these things, which certainly would take place by a rejection of Jesus' gift on the cross, any of these rejections is a sin. But if this sin also is paid for by Jesus' death on the cross, then no acceptance is necessary, because rejection being a sin is paid for. Your debt, which brings about as a result of your rejection, is paid for. Your rejection has no effect, and you are saved. Therefore, one is saved whether one accepts Jesus or rejects Jesus. And since all people in the world will ultimately fall into the category of acceptance or rejection of Jesus, then everybody goes to heaven. Again, follow the reasoning. If all sins were paid for by Jesus' death on the cross, then even the sin of rejection of Jesus was paid for by Jesus on the cross, and then rejection of Jesus does not put one in hell, and therefore Christianity has no value, acceptance of Jesus has no value, acceptance of the gospel message has no value. But of course, Jesus says quite different, and we all know in our hearts that it is quite different. So therefore, this position is patently absurd. Again, if all sin were paid for, no reparation on our part would be necessary. What salvation is the application of Jesus' merits on the cross to man to compensate for the sin of man so that he may enter heaven undefiled. Because anything defiled will not enter heaven. As Jesus tells us in the Gospel of St. Matthew, you must be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. You must believe and be baptized. You must feed the hungry and clothe the naked. What if you don't? As St. Paul says frequently, adulterers and fornicators and liars will not enter the kingdom of heaven. So if you commit adultery once, does that make you an adulterer forever? Well, if it does, then, as Jesus defines adultery as lust in the heart, very few men will go into heaven. But if you can somehow lose the status of being an adulterer after you commit the sin, by somehow purging yourself of that sin, even after it is forgiven, somehow change yourself, then again what we have is the concept of reparation for a sin, the balancing replacement, the homeostasis, the status of health restored following the proper therapy. When the body is diseased, it does not recover immediately. It must follow some procedure to allow the body to recover. When the soul is diseased, it must also follow some procedure to restore it to perfect health. Now, again, this concept of Jesus placing this inherent sense in us as our Creator, as our Lord, as our Savior, of this desire to do something, this desire to admit we are wrong, this desire to confess, this desire to restore things the way they were, all bring about the natural implication that, one, sin can be known in advance, which means that man has an inherent sense of right and wrong, that man's knowledge of what is right and wrong was not totally destroyed by original sin. Only our resistance to sin was weakened, not our acknowledgement of it. Therefore, Jesus' grace, Jesus' death on the cross, Jesus' life gives us an example of how to avoid sin. We already know how to recognize it. How to avoid sin. How to replace ourselves back in His proper grace once we have sinned. How to make reparation. How to clear the slate. How to get remission of the sin. Again, I hope that this has given you some sense of what sin is, some sense of a universalist, that is a Christian universal approach to it, some sense of the role of reparation, of justice, of mercy, of confession, and ultimately of purification. And the last point would be, of course, that if this reparation does not take place while alive, there must be something else, some other procedure, some other way that the reparation will take place. And of course, this would be after death. That, of course, is another subject and starts getting into sectarianism, and I'm trying to avoid that on this tape. Related tapes on this particular subject would be M1, forgiveness, that's M as in Mary 1, M5, that's M as in Mary 5, suffering, and M8, feelings. On the sectarian point of view would be T, that's T as in Thomas 2, the tape dealing with purgatory, and if you wish to know some of the mistakes that certain Christian denominations, so-called Christian denominations, have made, I would suggest that you obtain tape L5, Protestantism and Sin. That's L as in Lincoln 5. I believe these tapes will give you further information on dealing with sin, forgiveness, and the basic inherent concepts that I have attempted to deal with briefly here. Those tapes and additional copies of this tape may be obtained by writing to us at ARM, standing for All Roads Ministry, 55 Palen, P as in Paul, A-L-E-N, Road, L as in Lincoln, 38, that is Hope Well, that's one word, Junction, State is New York, the zip code is 12533. We welcome your comments, suggestions, criticisms. Please get in touch with us. Our phone number is on any of our literature. This tape is a production of All Roads Ministry. Your speaker is Vin Lewis, founder and president of All Roads Ministry. This particular tape is entitled Reason and Religion. Before I go any farther, allow me to define these terms. I think we all use them at times, but sometimes rather loosely. And as I will use them in a specific way, I believe that I should define them. Let me also state, though, in the beginning, that this particular series of tapes, unlike many of the tapes that come from All Roads Ministry, that is to say ARM, tries to approach basic issues in Christianity from a non-sectarian point of view. In other words, what I'm trying here is to be very impartial, very objective, and approach these things in such a way that anybody who calls themselves Christian, whether they be Catholic, Orthodox, Protestant, Mormon, anything whatsoever, if they are of good will find nothing to object to in these tapes. What we're trying to do is take a non-denominational approach to truth, to basic Christian issues, basic Christian problems. And from that, I hope that they tend less to, quote-unquote, scare people off, as I have been frequently accused of doing. With that in mind, let me get to the use of the words. Reason is that mental ability, or process, depending whether it is being used as a noun or a verb, by which man comes to a knowledge of truth. Now notice, The point here is reason has certainly a moral aspect. If you reason out a geometrical problem, you come to the proper conclusion, the proper solution. If you reason out a marital problem, you come to a resolution, or the closest thing you can come to a resolution. If you are a doctor and you use reason correctly, you'll come up with the right prognosis, diagnosis, therapy for your ill patient. Reason is to be contrasted with logic. Logic may be defined as a quite specific set of rules of inference by which a person may go from a premise, that is, a statement assumed to be true, by a set series of laws, rules, regulations, to a second conclusion, the truth of which is dependent on the truth of the premise. Logic is a self-contained system. Reason is an open system. Some things logically cannot be dealt with. Reasonableness can always be dealt with. As a matter of fact, one may consider reasonableness the ultimate criterion for logic. In other words, to give you a quick example, the statement, "Everything I say is a lie," cannot be dealt with logically. Reason will tell you that such a statement is, quite literally, a silly statement, a nonsense statement. Grammatically, it's correct, but it has a syntax error in the sense of it cannot convey information as a sentence. Religion is defined as that set of rules, regulations, procedures dealing with worship, morality, and creed, which regulate the relations between man and God, but from man to God. Obviously, God is not bound by religion. Religion, certainly in a Christian context, deals with those rules, regulations, morality, creed, etc., revealed by God to man to regulate man's behavior. Now, what I am trying to deal with in this tape is the relationships between reason and religion. The first point I would like to make is that there is a necessary, completely unavoidable relationship between the two. To put it slightly differently, wherever you find religion, you will always find the exercise of reason. No exceptions. This is simply the same way of saying wherever you find air, you will find nitrogen and oxygen. Why? Because air is defined as a mixture of those two gases, among others. This does not mean to say that every time you find reason, you will find religion. Reason can certainly exist outside of the religious area. All religious areas, no matter what religion it is, Christian or non-Christian, contain reason. Now, many times, particularly in the more, shall we say, hard-cased fundamentalist situation in the Christian community, so to speak, we find that the downplay of reason and the complete rejection of reason is pronounced, is proclaimed. The ordinary fundamentalist, so to speak, or I'm setting up a stereotypical one here, will point out that because of the fall of man, because of the corrupt, inherently corrupt nature of man, his reasoning capabilities, man cannot reason correctly. And therefore, in the areas of religion, it must be rejected. Now, in fact, all men reason all the time. But even to state that reason cannot be relied on in religious areas is to make a statement which is being advanced as reasonable. Simply to even read it in the Bible, if you could find such a passage, even to draw a conclusion of it, even to include it in one's creed, involves a rational process. One has taken the statement, put it into a sentence that conveys meaning, and advanced it in a certain sense of priority, and then use it as a criterion by which other things will be judged. These are all reasonable actions. So, the reason is unavoidable in any religious statement whatsoever, even in the statement of man's reason cannot be trusted. Because even to accept that and to pronounce it is a reasonable statement. The second thing, every religion, by the second reason why religion and reason go together, my second point, is that every religion, by definition, has standards. Every religion has a standard or standards by which exclusion and inclusion are made. Even if these standards are changeable, even if these standards are pure human tradition or reason, even if these standards claim to be purely political or administrative, in other words, the minimum age for a minister or a priest, they have come about only because men have sat down and reasoned them out. Even if one were to argue that the only way determinations are made in a certain religion, and I believe there is one in Southeast Asia, which uses a Ouija board, and the Ouija board somehow reflects the will of God, and the involuntary movement of the marker around spells out God's messages to us, even this involves reason. Because at a certain point, a selection process had to be made by which the Ouija board was determined. The placement of the Ouija board, the people who go on it. If we go by tarot cards, or if we go by, as the ancient Romans did, the internal organs of roosters and ducks and goats, which we now find silly, it is still reasonable. Because someone had to use a standard by which you could measure the liver, or the distortion of the liver. Now, when I use the word reasonable there, I'm using it in quotations. I'm not saying that one comes to a definite set of knowledge in the sense of the true knowledge, right reason, talking about morality. But I do mean to say that the seers, the diviners, the priests of even these crazy religions did have some standard by which they judge things. They did have to go to school or study under the apprenticeship of a master to learn how to read the liver of a goat or a chicken. Therefore, all religious systems, no matter how crazy they seem to us, no matter how demonic they are in either practice, nature, or origin, still have reason. This leads us to a problem. The problem is that reason itself cannot be measured by anything else. I believe this was first raised by Immanuel Kant, the philosopher of the 1700s, a German philosopher, in his Critique of Pure Reason. And what he essentially said was this: every time we reason, we are using a tool. The tool being, of course, reason, your mind. In order to determine if your mind is functioning correctly, the only way to do that is to go outside of the mind and judge it. To use an analogy, the only way to tell if the speedometer on the car is functioning correctly is to judge it with some standard. Now, that could be a speedometer measuring machine, or it could be a measured mile and a stopwatch, or it could be a radar gun that is used by a police department. But again, these now have to be measured by something else. And they have to be measured by something else. So, literally, at least in America, we have the Bureau of Standards in Washington, D.C., which has the yardstick, the pound. The yardstick is cut, and it is defined as the yardstick, and all of the yardsticks are to be measured by it. Now, this is an arbitrary decision and is of no problem. We can certainly understand it. In the same sense that time is determined to be 60 seconds, and there's probably some clock somewhere which is considered perfect, and it doesn't really matter anymore. In other words, this is an arbitrary definition. If when time was being set up, it was set up to be 55, a minute having 55 seconds or 75 seconds, it would make no difference. These are totally arbitrary concepts. But when we are trying to deal with something beyond ourselves, that is, to know whether our minds in fact work correctly, to know in fact that when we come to a conclusion, we are using reason, in order to test it, in order to get away from the trap of using the measuring device to measure itself, we must introduce another factor. What I am arguing is the other factor we introduce is the concept of natural law. In other words, this is the solution. The natural law is that law which is written on the hearts of man, which cries out for certain things, which gives us a sense of satisfaction when we do what is right, and a dissatisfaction when we do what is wrong. What we find is that this inherent sense of right and wrong, this law written on our hearts, is in fact universal to all men. Now, if we work on the concept, and I think we have to, that what is universal in man and good must come from God, then we come to the conclusion that if we find something universal and good in man, it is from God, and if we work on the concept, and we think we have to in the Christian context, that we are created not to live eternally on earth, but to live a certain time on earth, then to be judged at death, and then to be rewarded and punished eternally. So in other words, our proper goal is now to achieve salvation, to achieve entry into heaven, to have eternal happiness with God. This is our goal, this is our supernatural end. If God wants this for us, and again in a Christian context we must hold that he is, then we must hold that he gives us certain supernatural guides to guide us in advance to avoid evil and to do good, to recognize sin and reject it, to recognize virtue and accept it. The problem now is, of course, is reason a proper way to do it? If we assume it is, how do we test it? Because are we allowed to make an assumption on such a serious issue as this? Mainly reason. Can we rely on reason, or what me as, again, that stereotypical fundamentalist does, must he reject it? Well, the first two points show that reason is absolutely unavoidable with religion. And these ontological arguments, to use a fancy philosophical term, which means of the nature of the thing, means that reason must be an acceptable part of religion, because there is no way to have religion without it. That's my first argument. But the second is to return to the concept of natural law. What is written in our hearts which reinforces reason? Well, one way we can find this is by looking at the great literature of mankind, the great art of mankind, the great music of mankind, and the great common traits of religion of mankind. Now, great, I don't mean the concept of looking, again, at the liver of a chicken, but I mean great in the sense of those things which would be admired and accepted by all cultures. Example, all cultures admire courageous men, men who are willing to fight for a good cause unto death and stay where they are supposed to be. In other words, when they are appointed to guard their post, to die rather than to leave it. All cultures value the value of motherhood, that a mother should be concerned and endlessly loving for her young. All cultures value the concept of justice. All cultures value the value of truth. Now, what we find is that literature reinforces this, great literature. How shall we define great? That which endures through time and achieves a popularity both among the intelligentsia, in other words, the people who have the time to study it, and the people who work, the common crowd, who don't have the time to study it, but have the time to appreciate it. Why? Because this is appealing to what is universal in man, and it must be what is good. Because what is universal in man is accepted through time, is passed on from generation to generation without shame, and that's how things survive publicly, as opposed to the secret stuff that survives, the public stuff that survives, the stuff that wins the awards, the stuff that is constantly republished, such as Homer's Iliad, such as certainly the Bible, such as Dante's Divine Inferno, such as Virgil's Aeneid, speak of virtues, characteristics, traits, desires, goals, and values of men that are universal. Now, if we find that these universal values, which therefore must come from God, the reason they must come from God is they are good, by definition, as I have defined good, they are universal, therefore they come from God, because what is ever is universal in us comes from God. If these things also enforce and reinforce and confirm and affirm reason, then reason is, again, for a third reason, play on words there, for a third cause, for a third justification, reason or rational functioning is now a valid part of religion. And again, what we find is the same thing. The Christian religion, the Christian moral system teaches the same thing. The advocacy of motherhood, the advocacy of the courageous man, of the responsible man, of the protective man for his family, of the nurturing of the young, of sacrifice for one another, of adherence to the truth until death, of charity for those who are unfortunate, mercy for those who ask for it, compassion for those who mourn. All of these things are characterized both by our sense of reason and by our sense of Christian morality. One more point on this. Let us use reason again and see if it reinforces Christian morality. By definition, what we approve of, what we teach, what we advocate is likely to be repeated. Now, this is self-evident, I believe, but it is reasonable. Therefore, cultures, societies, states, nations, organizations reward that which they consider good and punish, or at least don't reward, that which they consider bad. Every father raises his son this way. Now, if it is likely to be repeated, if it becomes more general, then one is likely to receive as one teaches. Example, if one teaches that mercy is proper, if one teaches that truth is proper, if one teaches that adherence and reasonableness to one's contracts and obligations is proper, then when one needs to be told the truth, he is more likely to receive it. When one needs mercy, he is more likely to receive it. When one needs a responsible answer from someone else who has an obligation relationship to you, one is more likely to receive it. Since we all want truth, people to meet their obligations towards us, and all want mercy, it follows from that reason once again enforces morality. Again, that which we reward, that which we teach, that which we advocate is likely to be repeated. Now, you may have noticed, of course, that this is sort of a rephrasing of the Golden Rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But, of course, this presupposes, if you are reasonable about it, this will only apply if you have an inherent sense in you already what is right. The way Jesus put the Golden Rule is, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The way Confucius put it was, what you find offensive in yourself, do not do to your neighbor. Let me show you how Jesus' Golden Rule can only be understood, and of course it's a basic concept of Christian behavior, if we introduce reason. If we take a neighbor who is a sexual pervert, and he literally has sex with his daughter and then sacrifices her to some demon god, well, this is what turns him on, gives him pleasure. If he went out to do that to my family, take my daughter, have sex with my daughter, and sacrifice her, he would be following Jesus' rule, unless we introduced reason, because he would be doing unto others as he would have them do unto him. After all, he believes having sex with young girls and sacrificing them is a good thing. I'm using this absurd example to get the point across. The only way Jesus' phrase of do unto others as you would have them do unto you can be justified is if there is an inherent sense of reasonableness in us that we use as a criterion, a standard of judgment, to determine what we should do, what we should want, what we should want others to do to us. Notice the word should. Not what we do, but what we should do. This phrase itself must be accepted in a reasonable fashion. It must be understood reasonably. So now this is the fourth position, I believe, on why reasonableness must be used. Because if it does not follow that we use reason in these cases, we can come to the most absurd things by following the words of Jesus blindly. And as Jesus says, there are none so blind as those who will not see, none so deaf as those who will not hear. Now notice, what he's talking about is a voluntary blanking off of the eyes or a voluntary stopping off of the ears. Which means what? A refusal to allow information to enter the brain, which is, of course, in many ways, the beginning, or at least many times, the beginning of reasonable behavior and the beginning of rational discussion, evaluation, etc. Therefore, what I hope I have been able to establish, or at least give you an inclination of, is that religion, by its very nature, is inherently tied up, completely interconnected with, and totally dependent upon right reason. When I say right reason, I mean the reason which is the rational faculty by which one comes to an acceptance and a realization of knowledge and truth, which is in accord with God's will for man. And the way this is done is by following what is universally good, universally true, universally admired, and universally advocated throughout all times, because the universal must be correct. As far as this last point goes, there's a tape available from ORM. P1, Infallibility, deals with the concept of the universal concept of man necessarily being true. And if you have difficulty with that precept, upon which much of my positions tonight are based, I suggest that you obtain that tape and listen to it. But again, the key point here is that reason and religion are not enemies by any means. They are two roads that run parallel together. They start in the same place, in the mind and heart of man, and they end in the same place, the proper relationship with God, which ultimately means the reward of salvation, which will come to us when we are judged by God as having been worthy enough servants to achieve salvation. This subject is rather deep, and I hope that I have kept it on a level that is understandable to all levels. And I don't mean that in any patronizing fashion. However, to deal with certain other issues which are related, I would suggest that you obtain other tapes from ORM, which might make, if you've had any difficulty with this tape, some of the positions clearer. One that I would recommend is M8, that's M as in Mary 8, Feelings. Another one is M7, Sin. Also, as I mentioned before, P, that's P as in Paul 1, which deals with infallibility. The major point here being that everything which is universally accepted by man must be true and must be a reflection of God's reality. Also available, I believe, related in the philosophy tapes that would be also designated under P, that is P as Paul or P as philosophy, would be the P2 tape, which deals with knowledge, the concept of affirming truths. Also, P3, Elements of Logic, in which I believe the concept is explained between knowledge and reason, perhaps a little better. Also, especially as I mentioned before, some background on Immanuel Kant might be admirable and certainly might be useful. And I would suggest you obtain P4, which deals with some of Immanuel Kant's concepts of knowledge and a priori nature, a posteriori nature. The title of that tape is Immanuel Kant for Everyone. As a summary, let me point out that right reason cannot be wrong, but that sort of seems by definition. Reason can be fooled in the sense that a reasonable person can, through fatigue, through errors, through failures, etc., come to an unreasonable conclusion. But reason itself, if followed correctly, is a proper criterion, it is a proper method, it is a perfectly valid source, and it is a valid method to come to religious truth. Now, this does not mean to say that every reasonable activity or every rational discussion or every rational effort is one that is easy. But we must hold as Christians this, that if we seek truth with our heart and ask for wisdom, and wisdom is certainly related to reason, wisdom being essentially knowing God's plan for man, and sometimes knowing which questions to ask and which ones to wait until later to ask, that is after death, we must believe that wisdom will be given to us if we ask, because Jesus says so. We must believe that if we ask, it will be given to us, as Jesus says so. And we must believe that we will know the truth and it will set us free. If we know the truth, and if we start with the truth that is written in our hearts and is available to us in our brains, then reason has no limits leading us into the correct area. The key thing, of course, is to watch out when our enemy, primarily the devil, will make what appears to be what is not reasonable appear to be reasonable. And we must understand that. In other words, we must be on guard against the devil in this area as we are in any other. The primary failure, of course, being the concept that we think reason is of our own accord and not a gift from God, and that reason can somehow conflict with the basic morality, which is in our hearts, the basic natural law. If we find a conflict on those two, it is our obligation to resolve it, either by further study or ultimately by rejecting what we think is reason, for in that case, it is false. Reason cannot conflict with truth, with morality, or with natural law, because all of these gifts are given to us by God for the same purpose, to bring us closer to Him and increase our own chances of salvation. Additional copies of this tape, or any of the other related tapes which I have mentioned, may be obtained by contacting us. You may write us at ARM, for All Roads Ministry, 55 Palen, P as in Paul, A-L-E-N, Road, L as in Lincoln, 38. Post office is Hopewell, that's one word, Junction, state is New York, zip code 12533. Again, this is Vin Lewis, founder and president of All Roads Ministry, thanking you for listening. Hope that this tape has been of use to you, and hope it's brought you a little closer to God. We're always interested in your suggestions, criticisms, questions, etc. Feel free to contact me personally. Thank you for listening. God bless.